Thank you. Be seated. Justice Owen has recused voluntarily and will take no part in the deliberation or decision in this hall. Ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Barcelo v. Elliott.
May it please the court, Mr. Gary McCloud will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. The central and singular issue presented to this court by this appeal is whether this court should create a limited exception to the concept of privity as a bar to a suit against an attorney for negligent draftsmanship and implementation of a testamentary scheme. This concept of privity has been determined to be outmoded in a large number of the jurisdictions that have decided this question in contemporary times. There have been citations in Texas cases, and apparently those cases have relied upon the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in National Savings Bank versus Ward, an 1879 case decided at a time when privity was a bar to just about everything in connection with suits, for instance, for product liability, dangerous defects, and the like. And the reason given by the U.S. Supreme Court at that time for the privity bar were twofold. The concern of the court at that time was that if such liability were allowed, it would deprive the parties to the contract of control of their own agreement, and that a duty to the general public would impose a huge potential burden of liability on the contracting parties, the so-called limitless class. As this court, I'm sure, knows, that beginning in the 1920s, with some decisions by Justice Cardozo while he sat on the New York court, the privity bar to things such as product liability and dangerous products, defects, was overruled. However, the privity bar remained in effect as to suits against attorneys nationally until the California Court, Supreme Court, in 1958 decided what would be the precursor of its later decisions in the Biancana versus Irving case, in which that court announced for the first time its so-called balancing of factors test to determine whether or not there was a duty owed to an intended beneficiary who was a non-client or non-contracting party. Now, of course, the Biancana case involved a notary public. However, the California Supreme Court used its decision in Biancana to later decide Lucas v. Ham and subsequently Heyer v. Slade, both of which were lawyer cases. And in those cases, they refined the test in Biancana to add to what they originally listed as six factors to be used in the balancing of factors test, to add one additional factor in the case of an attorney, and that is the question of undue burden, which was the undue burden to the profession if such liability were granted. That's essentially the same basis that was used by the U.S. Supreme Court as one of the reasons not to grant privity in cases involving attorneys.
Counsel, what we do is to ask, what is the rationale for limiting just attorneys? Why not, once the door is open, the third party claims against attorneys, why not against architects, engineers, physicians, or any other profession? What is the rationale for just cutting it here, applying to testamentary situations with lawyers?
Well, the first obvious answer to that, Your Honor, would be that it's not necessary in this case. In the first place, the privity bar, as applied in the very limited fact situation that we have here, is one that prohibits or prevents injured parties from even having a remedy. That's not necessarily true in other cases, such as in cases where you have negligent representation suits against professionals such as CPAs. The privity bar there has not been a bar to suits against the attorneys for CPAs for negligent representation, because they were found to owe a duty to foreseeable parties involved that could rely upon their negligently certified financial statements. In those kind of cases, though the plaintiff also obviously had a cause of action against another party, they wanted to add to the parties that they could bring those actions against, obviously seeking deeper fines. That's not the case here. If you have a testamentary scheme that's been frustrated by the negligence of an attorney in the drafting or implementation of that scheme, under traditional notions of the privity bar, the beneficiary is simply out of luck, has no right.
In this case, the trust was held to be void?
Yes, ma'am.
For what reason?
The court did not cite any reasons in the order that found it to be null and void. However, the motion that was filed in the probate proceeding as a basis for that court's order claimed that there were several grounds for which the trust was void. First was that there was that the trust was not executed by the trustee. The second ground was that the trust was never executed by delivery of any of the any of the trust race or corpus to the trustee, since there was no trustee that had been.
So there was a will that was probated.
There was a will that was offered for probate, and there was developed a contest to that will.
Was the trust part of the will?
The trust was an inter vivos trust and technically was not part of the will, but it was tied to the will because the will provided in its own language that the residuary of the estate would pour over into this existing trust. The third reason, and the reason I think the court granted the motion that was made to hold the trust void and of no effect, was that the trust was obviously designed from its wording to continue after the death of Mrs. Barcelo, but the drafter of the trust agreement provided in that trust that it terminated upon her death. Therefore, there was nothing there that could receive the residuary pour over out of the estate because the trust ceased to exist or death.
And the attorney had prepared the will and the trust.
That's correct.
Ms. McConnell, one of the responses had to do with the attorney-client privilege. Looking at the fact allegation that the trust was not executed, suppose the client comes to the lawyer and says, I've got family problems I've got to work out. I'm not quite sure how they're going to do, but I've got to take care of my estate. And the lawyer says, okay, here's your will, here's your trust. Now, I prepared the documents, but understand they're not going to become effective until you execute them and you start transferring property to the trust. But the documents are prepared, it's ready to go. When you decide that's what you'll do, then do it. But I understand you've got these problems with your family, and so we'll not do it today, but you just let me know. And then she dies unexpectedly. Now, the beneficiaries come in and say, whoops, we see by this will that we should have this trust and we should have this. Now we're going to sue you, lawyer, for not having gotten it executed. How can the lawyer step forward and say, well, I discussed it with my client. My client has problems with you all, and my client didn't want to execute it at the time we prepped them. How does the lawyer get on the stand and defend in this, I guess, the facts of this case? The trust wasn't executed. How does the lawyer get up to defend that it wasn't just negligence that wasn't executed? It was because the client didn't want to execute.
Within the facts of this case, Your Honor, I think it's very simple. And I assume that you're directing the question in the framework of the attorney-client privilege. This court decided back in a court of appeals out of San Antonio back in 1941 in Crum versus Porter, which is 152 Southwest 2nd 495, and I didn't cite this in my brief, which was writ refuted, meaning this court essentially adopted the opinion, held that the attorney-client privilege, insofar as testimony concerning the facts and circumstances surrounding the execution or the contents or the discussion concerning the implementation of the testamentary documents, was not covered by the attorney-client privilege. And so in what you proposed in your hypothetical there, it would be very simple for the attorney to take the stand and testify to that. He's not going to be prohibited by the attorney-client privilege. And in fact, under the facts or under the holding of Crum, couldn't assert the attorney-client privilege in that regard. Now, I can envision...
Does the privilege survive one's death?
I'm sorry?
Does the attorney-client privilege survive the client's death in any circumstances?
My research in that area has shown, I have not found a Texas case that says it does. I did find the Crum case, which when it talked specifically about the testamentary documents, it said it didn't survive the death of the testator slash trustor. And Crum has been cited in contemporary cases, one of which I believe, and don't hold me to this, but I think it was the one of the cases concerning the right of the third-party beneficiary to sue, which I believe was the Dallas Court of Appeals case in Thomas v. Pryor, if I recall right. I think the Thomas Court cited Crum versus Porter for that holding. But the, and I don't want to get off, I understand that there's pending before this court another case that addresses specifically the attorney-client privilege, which is the Huey case. And there's been, I'm reading some of the briefs in connection with that, there's been some contention that the fact issue, or the issue there, the legal issue there, might implicate the Barcelow case, but that, in my mind, is not correct. The Barcelow case presents, this case presents a very separate issue from that in the Huey case. We're not talking about attorney-client privilege. Now, it is true, Justice Enoch, that One of the things that's been raised by the respondents, or the respondents in this case, as a reason not to adopt this limited exception to the privilege bar is it would impact the attorney-client privilege between the attorneys and clients in general cases where the profession as a whole might be vulnerable to suit. And whereas that might have some appeal superficially, If you talk specifically about a case involving negligent draftsmanship of testamentary documents, that concern goes away for the reason, as I pointed out in the holding in Crum versus Porter, there is no attorney-client privilege that survives the death of the testator. Further, you're not presented with a conflict of interest because, obviously, when a testator approaches an attorney to prepare a will or trust or some testamentary sort of scheme, that testator is doing so to benefit a third party, you know, some relative, friend, whatever they choose to do. And it is one of the reasons they're seeking to get these testamentary documents is to effectuate this gift or devise to this third party. And in order to give effect to the testator's intentions and to see that they're carried out, there must be some incentive from the standpoint of the law to provide that if those intentions are not carried out, then someone has to pay the price.
Well, that's a very simplistic view of probate cases, though, because the books are full of cases that argue about what did they mean. I think he meant to give me it all. Well, I think he meant to give me it all. Well, I don't. And that's the whole problem in probate cases is what did Mama mean? What was the exact intent? It seems to me there would be rife with arguments in those cases.
I don't think that that would be applicable in the limited exception that we're urging to the court here today.
Why not? Because the one beneficiary says, you obviously misdrew these papers because I didn't get what the testator wanted me to have, and another beneficiary says, "Oh no, they were drawn exactly right. That's exactly what was meant to happen after all." And the lawyer will be caught in the middle of all that.
To answer your question, I would simply say that as I have read the cases across the country that have addressed this particular issue, what they've said is that you limit this exception to the direct intended beneficiaries. In other words, as in this case.
Why can't I claim that Howard Hughes intended to leave me half his fortune? And that's what he told the lawyer, and it didn't get written down.
Because if you're talking about subjective intentions, I don't think that they would fit within this exception that we're urging upon the court.
Justice Hickman, if that in mind, what's the threshold to get into the court?
The threshold is that you've got a document here that says, I will devise, bequeath, and gift to John Doe. X number of dollars, a certain piece of property, certain type of property, that is a direct intended beneficiary. Now, if that will, in this particular case, if were the testator desired to gift to her six grandchildren, five of whom are the petitioners in this case, specific property, and in that property is the residuary, and that residuary is to go into the trust which is for the benefit of these six children, no one else. Those six children are specifically named. Those are direct intended beneficiaries of that testamentary scheme.
If the lawyer had allegedly dropped out one of the grandchildren's names by mistake, and named five of the six, the sixth one would not have a six.
Under the limited exception that we're urging, I think that you have to draw a line somewhere. And that line has to be drawn in such a way, in fact, a couple of the courts that I've cited the opinions to have said that to have someone come in and make a claim that they were intended to be beneficiaries of this trust, but were simply omitted, is going too far because there's nothing objectively to show that they were intended to be named.
And nor would you allow somebody to say the percentage should have been different.
Absolutely.
I should have gotten a third rather than a sixth.
Absolutely. I think what I'm urging to the court, what the petitioner's basis for this appeal is that you need to limit it. I mean, we're all lawyers. Nobody wants to subjectively open the door to unlimited liability. That's one of the arguments that's made. But if you carefully limit that exception to the known, identifiable, and direct beneficiaries, which one of the cases that I've cited states is the basis, I think that's the Schreiner case, the Iowa Supreme Court case, that says we're going to limit it to the known, identifiable beneficiaries, and they have to show that not only they're known, identifiable, and direct beneficiaries, they have to show that they suffered a loss. And if they meet those two categories, then we will recognize them as having a cause of action against the attorney.
And to be clear, I guess the cause of action is you breached your duty to represent your client with the appropriate degree of expertise. Not that you breached the duty of me or somebody else.
I think if you could, there are several different theories of recovery that I've addressed in the brief. Probably the most applicable one to Texas would be the third-party beneficiary concept of creating a duty, because as you know, an attorney
duty directly to the plaintiff.
Oh, directly to the plaintiff, because under the third-party beneficiary analysis, it's foreseeable that they're identifiable and that the attorney should owe a duty to them to see that that's carried out.
If you owe a duty, aren't you really representing them?
It's a very similar analysis. If you owe the duty, if that duty is created, however it's done, it's the same kind of duty that would exist in an ordinary attorney negligence case.
But going in a probate context, you don't know when the testator comes in your office whether you can represent the beneficiaries or not. There may be a conflict.
There could be as of that time. I think that conflict disappears once the testamentary scheme is put into effect, because I think at that time the interests of the testator and the interest of the beneficiary are the same.
But when you undertake that employment, the thought has to be in the lawyer's mind, I'm representing this person and this person's intended beneficiaries.
I don't know that it's necessary to say that you're representing them. I think what you have to ask yourself
is... You said a little earlier, what?
What I'm saying is that you apply the same kind of analysis as far as the creation of the duty, but it's a third-party beneficiary analysis, not the direct attorney-client analysis. Third-party beneficiary analysis has been used by virtually every case that's been decided since the Bianconi case in 1958 to arrive at this conclusion. The problem is that I think any attorney that sits down, whether it's for to draw up a will or a trust, to consider any kind of case, has to determine at that time the potential for conflicts. And a probate attorney should be no different. Now, I don't...
Except the probate attorney doesn't undertake to represent, ordinarily, anybody other than the person sitting in front of them.
I understand that. And if this exception is adopted, that's going to put a little bit more of a burden on the attorney to undertake that. For which, as Professor Eisenberg points out in his article in the Columbia Law Review, entitled Third Party Beneficiaries, he says that that's something essentially that's no different than any other attorney would have to do. He can charge a premium for this additional burden, in the form of fees, but that pretty much represents what any other attorney that's representing a client is going to do because of his exposure to liability.
Thank you. Let me ask you a question. I don't know if your time has expired, but I'm curious. These six petitioners are grandchildren of the deceased.
There's actually, I think, five petitioners. One of the grandchildren didn't join in this suit.
Fine. Who were the, since the probate court declared the trust was void, did it lapse in the state? Who was the beneficiary? Who got the money?
Under the ruling of the court, the residuary did not pass through the will, so therefore it passed by intestacy, and the four children who were the parents of these grandchildren received the residuary.
So these kids' parents got the money and say, parents, you know, we want the money. Is that a fight between kids and their parents?
It was a fight between two of the children and essentially two other children plus the grandchildren.
And the brief of the respondents states that the probate court declared the trust was void for reasons unrelated to any conduct of respondents.
I disagree with that entirely. That is not true. The thing, what the court, the probate court had before it at the time was the motion of the two children that were challenging the efficacy of this trust. And as I've already, in answer to Justice Spector's question, I set out those three grounds, the three bases that were set forth in that motion, so the court had to have granted them on one of those three bases.
And what is the value of the trust that was declared invalid?
The trust, well, subject to proof, of course, but we estimated that the value of the trust, had it been properly implemented, would have included about a 52 or 53% controlling interest in a nursing home corporation in Pearland, Texas, that had a value, a total value of about $3.5 million.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Billy Shepherd will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, good morning. As I understand the petitioner's argument, it is that the non-clients should be able to sue lawyers who drafted some sort of testamentary scheme because the non-client beneficiaries have no other remedy. Well, I don't think that's correct. I think their remedy is in the nature of a constructive trust. And this court has held, and it's a law in the state of Texas, that when one party holds property, that in equity should belong to another party, a constructive trust is proper.
They're not saying equity here. That's a matter of law. They said if your client had properly done the trust agreement, they would be, as a matter of law, entitled to the proceeds of that trust.
Excuse me?
They don't want equity. They want it as a matter of law. If your client had properly discharged his professional duties, the probate court would have not declared the trust invalid, and they, as a matter of law, would be entitled to the proceeds under the trust agreement.
That is correct. That is correct. But in equity, they do have a remedy.
And that can be imposed without any fault on the part of the respondent?
It can, and it can be imposed based upon mistake. And I'd like to give the court a side of the case. It's not in my brief. And it's called Cock versus Pacific Gulf Development Corporation, 594 Southwest 2nd, 545, 548, 549.
Now, that's not a remedy against the attorney.
No, Your Honor, it's not. But it is a remedy to get the money, the funds, that they claim were owed to them pursuant to the trust. Accepting their allegations as true, they're saying because of a mistake made by David Elliott, they did not receive the residue of Francis's estate.
Can you bring the government in for any extra tax dollars they may have gotten?
That I don't think.
The attorney's mistake.
That I don't think.
Which was going to be my question. If in estate planning, the purposes of the instrument are to diminish the amount of taxes that the beneficiaries would owe, and it has the opposite effect, is there any remedy there for, you know, the will is valid, all the instruments are valid, but the farm has to be sold to pay the taxes.
let me address it this way. Those are not facts involved in this case, tax issues. However, there could be a set of facts where there was a remedy, because under your hypothetical, the estate would be damaged because of the tax liability. In that case, the personal representative of the estate,
can
the executor, can in fact sue the lawyer for legal malpractice because the executor is in the shoes of the deceased.
Okay.
In any event, a constructive trust was a remedy available to these petitioners. It is a remedy that they chose not to take, which would have involved them suing their parents to get the money that they are claiming is owed to them in this lawsuit. And that brings me to the first of several policy reasons why.
Well, that, even whether they sue their parents or not, this is the fight between the grandparents, the parents and the kids.
Correct. Correct. That brings me to the first of several policy reasons why we believe, under the facts of this case, the Barcelos should not be able to sue the lawyer. And that is, the lawyer who represented the petitioner's parents against the petitioners and having the trust declared invalid so the petitioners did not get the residue of Francis' estate is Mr. McConnell. The same lawyer that's representing the petitioners saying, because the trust was declared invalid, we didn't get the residue of the estate in this case. What it's going to do under the facts of a case like this, if the petitioners are allowed to sue the lawyer, it's going to push the door wide open for collusion and a double recovery. What the petitioners have decided to do here is not pursue the actual property that they say they didn't get. That would involve suing Mr. McConnell's former clients. Instead, they're suing the lawyer. And what the Barcelo family is trying to do here is double their money. And that's wrong. And as a matter of policy, I think this court should say that petitioners cannot try to double their money under the facts of this case. I'd like to move on to the attorney-client privilege issue and the confidential information issue, and first say that I've never heard that the attorney-client privilege expires when one dies. Texas Rule of Evidence 503 does not say it expires when one dies. Disciplinary Rule 1.05, which requires lawyers keep confidential communications confidential, does not say that that duty expires when one dies. Comment 1 to Rule 1.5 goes on to say that the confidentiality requirements between an attorney and a client are so important that they're necessary to the proper functioning of a legal system.
What about a claim that would not breach any attorney-client confidence, say some sort of mechanical defect in the execution of a will that witnesses didn't subscribe it and thus it couldn't be probated? That wouldn't involve a...
It would not, and there are certainly hypotheticals out there that would not involve the disclosure of attorney-client privileges. I can tell you in this case, it's going to involve the disclosure of attorney-client privileges. And, you know, we reach an important exception to the attorney-client privilege rule, and that is that it's waived if the attorney gets sued for legal malpractice. That's embodied in both Rule 503 in the Rules of Evidence and Rule 1.05 in our disciplinary rule. If a lawyer sued for legal malpractice and he cannot disclose client competencies, he might unfairly lose that case on the merits. On the other hand, if he sued for legal malpractice and he does disclose client competencies, he just violated the disciplinary rules. He gets a grievance filed against him. He might get a legal malpractice case filed against him, which he's going to lose because he violated the attorney-client privilege. Therefore, I think for this court to hold that non-clients can sue lawyers, you know, under any set of circumstances, the court's also going to have to hold that non-clients can waive a client's attorney-client privilege. I think this court's also going to have to see to it that Texas Disciplinary Rule 1.05 is amended, because lawyers will have absolutely no choice but to violate that rule if they want to defend themselves and have a fair trial in a case where they're sued by a non-client.
Well, now, some states have relaxed the privilege requirement, and the sky didn't fall. Why is it going to fall in Texas?
Your Honor, I have read every case cited by the petitioners and many more, and not one of those cases discusses all of these policy considerations that I've discussed in my brief and that I'm going to discuss here today. And I do not know why, unless the attorneys representing the lawyers didn't raise it.
Have any of these cases ever been overruled by legislation or by a subsequent court opinion?
Not to my knowledge. We move on to the third policy reason why the petitioner should not be allowed to sue the lawyers in this case, and that is that our disciplinary rules at Rule 1.06 and Rule 5.04 require that we exercise our judgment solely on behalf of our clients and not on behalf of anyone else. If third parties can sue lawyers, lawyers' judgment is necessarily going to be influenced by persons other than the client. Lawyers will necessarily violate Disciplinary Rule 1.06. Lawyers will necessarily violate Disciplinary Rule 5.04.
Well, not so if...
Go ahead. We have the same question.
Not so if, as we discussed with Mr. McConnell just a moment ago, the owing of the duty gives rise to a representation as well. And they're not a third party. They're part of the client.
Well, if the owing of the duty gives rise to representation of them as well, we get to our next issue, which is conflict of interest. That would have to be disclosed up front to the testator or trustor, as the case may be, because testators and beneficiaries and then beneficiaries among themselves often have conflicts.
Why would there be a conflict between me and somebody that I wanted to give a certain amount of money to? If this suit was restricted to those people named in the will in the amount and procedure by which they're named in the will, how is there any, why isn't there a complete unity of interest between the decedent and the beneficiary?
Let me give you an example, and then I'd like to jump back and tie it into this requirement to exercise a judgment solely on behalf of the client. Suppose a beneficiary named in a will or a trust says, I should have gotten $100,000 rather than $50,000.
And the number in the will or trust is $50,000.
But the number in the will or trust is $50,000.
Yeah, but counsel already said in that situation, what he proposed, there would be no suit for that. You can only get the amount that's named.
I want to tie what I said in back to this exercising our judgment solely on behalf of the client, and I think this will all come together. But suppose a beneficiary decides they should get $100,000, and they tell the attorney, or the attorney hears that beneficiary A says the trustor is going to give me $100,000 in the trust. In that instance, is it not in the attorney's interest to try to convince the trustor, testator, to give more to that beneficiary versus another beneficiary in the case? In which case, the attorney is no longer exercising his judgment solely on behalf of the testator or the trustor. He's exercising his judgment on behalf of third parties. And that's a problem. That's a violation of the disciplinary rule. I'd like to go on to yet another policy reason and for not allowing the petitioners to sue my clients in this case, and that is that I truly believe, and I believe Mr. McConnell conceded this, that it's certainly going to drive the price of getting probate work done up, and it's going to drive the quality of the services down. I think good lawyers are no longer going to draft wills and trusts.
But you admit, in every other instance except representing dead people, there is a possibility that attorneys can be sued.
Never by non-clients.
Pardon?
But
no,
never by non-clients.
By clients, but that factored in, that's part of buying the insurance and factored into the price.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But
this rule as a policy matter would only, all that would do would be level this out so that everybody would have equal exposure within the firm.
Well, quite frankly.
Except for judges.
There you go. I don't think it would level it out because attorneys are going to be subject to liability from persons they've never met, that they've only heard of because their name is on a piece of paper. That's a lot different than being liable to a client with whom you have a confidential and fiduciary relationship. I truly believe that good attorneys will no longer draft wills and trusts, and I truly believe that the price of getting a good will or good trust done is going to go up, not only because of increased risk, but because malpractice premiums are going up, and because the supply of lawyers doing it are going down.
It just looks like to me you'd be obliged to call in those beneficiaries and get them to sign off on what you were doing, which would make it a better product.
Your Honor, the problem with that is that often in the estate planning context, the testator or trustor doesn't want to let the beneficiaries know who they are. And I've seen it often. That's a secret. And you are not allowed to tell the beneficiaries who they are or what they're getting.
Well, they'd have to give that up.
They would have to give that up. And I think that's going to have a serious adverse effect on quite frankly, the family system that we have. That's going to cause problems when a beneficiary learns that his mother or father has left $100,000 to brother Johnny and $10,000 to sister Clara.
But I thought we determined that we're talking about instances where the will sets out the beneficiary, but because of poor drafting of the will is set aside.
We are, but in response to that, the question was, when a will or trust is drafted, testamentary will or trust is drafted, we're going to have to call in the beneficiaries and get them to sign off.
I don't see how there's any requirement of that if we're only talking about instruments that are negligently prepared on their face.
Well, Your Honor, whether they're the instrument we have in this case is not an instrument that on its face was negligently prepared. The petitioner are claiming it was invalid for reasons other than anything you can look at the piece of paper and say this was negligently prepared. They're saying it wasn't funded, it wasn't signed by the trustee. Those are different things.
Well, it seems to me that
Mr. Mercy,
it's different from the situation.
Mr. Shepherd, one of the comments Mr. McConnell raised was an element that beneficiaries would have to show that they were harmed. Why wouldn't the narrow application to beneficiaries who could show that their positions materially were changed in reliance on them being designated as beneficiaries in a will or trust that ultimately did not do what it was supposed to do to the negligence of the attorney, not be a sufficient safeguard in these circumstances, if that would protect the attorney, or rather waive the attorney-client privilege to the settlor, because it would almost, by definition, mean that the testator or the settlor had talked to the beneficiaries about their plans and led them into changing their position in anticipation of this coming through. Why wouldn't, by an element being that the beneficiaries have to be injured, have to change their position somehow, not be the element that solves all the problems you're talking about, being a big secret and not wanting to know and that sort of thing?
Well, and let me ask, are we assuming that the attorney-client privilege has been waived?
Not assuming that the attorney-client privilege has been waived, but with respect to this cause of action only existing where the beneficiaries have changed their position, that the testator settlor could not expect the attorney to maintain some sort of attorney-client privilege on why the document didn't do what the testator was telling the beneficiaries the document would do.
And let me tell you why that doesn't, for example, solve the attorney-client privilege problem. Suppose that trustor leaves in a trust or tells a beneficiary that I'm leaving in a trust $1 million to you. Beneficiary changes his position based upon that representation. Attorney drafts the trust and hypothetically tells the trustor, okay, you got to go fund this trust before you die, or it ain't going to be any good. Well, trustor doesn't fund the trust and dies, so the trust is no good. You've got a beneficiary that's materially changed their position, suing an attorney who advised the trustor to fund the trust, but the trustor absolutely did not do it. And the attorney is bound by the confidentiality rules to not disclose in defending himself that I told the trustor to go fund the trust. I've got a letter right here that says it's certified mail. And the trustor never did it. That would be an absolute defense to the extent the trier of fact believed that.
But I'm suggesting this in response to Justice Heck's comment about bringing beneficiaries to talk. You say, but one of the most valuable things about this is that the testator doesn't want to tell anybody. I'm saying, but if the exception is so narrow that the beneficiaries have to change it, it presupposes that the testator has told them about it, that they've relied on it, so the testator couldn't expect, would not have the right to expect the lawyer to maintain confidentiality in that circumstance. Wouldn't that solve that problem?
Well,
this would only occur when the testator is telling people about it, as opposed to people.
I think there's a difference between the testator telling the beneficiaries, I've left you $1 million, and the testator making a blanket waiver of attorney-client communication between the testator and the attorney who drafted the trust. Simply telling a beneficiary that I've left you $1 million does not waive the privilege to the extent that the attorney gives confidential advice about the trust, unless this court says that's a waiver of it. I'm not aware of any law in existence today that would say that constitutes a waiver of other confidential communications between the attorney and the client.
I'm talking about with respect to the narrow issue of why this document doesn't transfer that $1 million.
I understand. And if that document does not transfer the $1 million because the attorney said, you got to go fund it tomorrow, and the client didn't do that, it's simply the client telling the beneficiary that I've left you $1 million, a waiver of the privilege as it applies to that advice from the attorney to the client? I certainly don't think it is under the law the way it is today. I'd just like to very briefly add that one other possible problem, and it's not contained in my brief, is that when we defend legal malpractice cases, and when we contend that the client does not follow advice or says they're going to do something that they don't do, we let the trier of fact affirmatively consider that by pleading contributory negligence. And then the trier of fact gets to write a number down by the client's name for the apportion of responsibilities to be attributed to the client. If non-clients can sue lawyers under these circumstances, we will be stripped of that defense. Although we can certainly argue, if the court holds that the attorney-client privilege is waived, that the client did something wrong or that the client was negligent, we don't have a mechanism by which to let the jury write a number down on a client's name to reduce our portion of the responsibility.
Mr. Shepard, what do you mean in your brief on page 5 when you say that probate court declared the trust was void for reasons unrelated to the conduct of your client?
I believe that the probate court declared that the trust was invalid because the trust was not funded.
Well, this is something, it was not funded because of the actions of your client.
That is not our position in this lawsuit. That if this case were to be reversed and we were to get into the merits of that lawsuit, that would not be our position. Our client did not cause that trust to not be funded.
Well, what caused it not to be funded? Was it not poor drafting?
It was not poor drafting, and let me tell you the problem I'm having here. Is I think that's privilege. That might be privilege information. And I don't know that I'm free to disclose it to you. But I can tell you, if this gets reversed and if this privilege is waived, there is going to be a real big fight about that. Thank you very
any
much.
Any other questions? Thank you, ma'am. Opposing counsel says there's nothing on the face of these documents that would indicate that they don't, as a group, accurately and completely reflect the testator's intent.
I disagree with that. I think that you have to consider both the will and the trust because they are tied together by the pour-over provision. If you read the will and you read the trust, you will see that the drafter of the trust expressly provided in the trust that it terminated at her death. Even though he put into the will that upon her death, the residuary of her estate goes to the trust. So I think on its face, it's invalid. And I strongly disagree with Mr. Shepard because I think that's the reason the trial court or the probate court determined that the will was null and void and of no effect.
There were no findings of fact and conclusions of law?
No, there wasn't. No one proceeded to take this up on appeal, neither side. Obviously, the two children that were challenging the trust were happy that the court threw out the trust. The other side chose not to appeal. And subsequently, and this probably had something to do with that, there was a family agreement entered into to settle all disputed matters in probate context. Now,
except they're searching for another deep pocket. What about the argument about double recovery?
There is no double recovery in this regard. Unless you presuppose, of course, I guess you could make the argument that if the four children that received the residuary of the estate that should have gone into the trust intend to and have made provisions to devise exactly what they received over their children, That would be a double recovery, but I think that's so remote and speculative that that couldn't be considered.
What about the possibility of collusion? You know, we have a family situation where the parents and their children have gotten together and said, okay, let's settle our differences, but let's gang up against lawyers.
I would say that that is always a possibility in any lawsuit. As I sat here this morning and listened to the argument concerning the bad faith case, I think there were certainly some concerns expressed by the attorney for the insurance company that there could be collusion in that regard. I think collusion is always something that a defense attorney would throw out and say, this is the reason you shouldn't consider creating this cause of action because it's too easy for people to conspire to bring this cause of action. I think that's something that is possible in any case. I don't think that ought to be a reason to not grant some limited relief to the intended beneficiary.
If we were to hold for you and find that privity is not a requirement and that strangers can sue an attorney when the attorney does not have a relationship with them, you agree that there would be a radical change in the practice of law in Texas, and we would have to disapprove of a host of court of appeals cases?
I don't think I agree with that entirely, because if you grant the relief we're seeking, that is the limited exception to the privity bar, I don't think that you're looking at giving a wholesale change in attorneys' liability to third parties. Quite frankly, it's not necessary. Giving a wholesale change in attorneys' liability to third parties. Quite frankly, it's not necessary. There's no reason to grant to adversaries the right to sue an attorney because they have some perceived grievance against the attorney for doing something wrong in the course of litigation. The case that comes to mind, of course, is the physician that sued the attorney claiming that the attorney owed him a duty not to bring a frivolous lawsuit against him. And that's never been held in any of these other jurisdictions to good basis. Negligent representation. This case does not present that issue to the court. And I don't think the court ought to do more than what's required in the facts of this case in creating this exception, because in virtually every case except perhaps for California, there has been a retention of the privity bar in general to negligent cases. If you look at the Guy versus Leiterbach case, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court there said, we're going to recognize a limited exception, but we're going to maintain the general rule as privity is a bar to suit by non-clients with attorney's negligence. And that's exactly what we're seeking here. But one thing that concerns me about the respondent's argument, and I want to make sure that the court understands I'm not misinterpreting the holding of Crum. I'll read to you very briefly what Crum says. It says, in regard to the execution and drafting of wills, the knowledge gained by the attorney is privileged during the lifetime of the testator. But the confidence reposed is temporary only, and after the death of the testator, the attorney may testify as to any facts affecting the execution or contents of the will. If you want to know about those contents,
your time has expired.
One quick question. Under what circumstances can the representative of the estate sue the attorney who drafted the will?
Well, I don't think that the representative of the estate can sue the attorney that drafted the will, because there can be no showing of damage.
He said there was, if the estate had been diminished by the payment of taxes. Are there other instances where the estate...
The only thing that's been referred to in the decisions I've seen, and probably would make sense, is an attorney's fees. Whatever the testator paid the attorney for drawing up what was a negligently drafted will or trust would be recoverable. But that, as you can imagine, would be fairly innocuous and would probably not spark a lawsuit just for that purpose. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
Audience, please rise.